Last week we started to talking about what I would call the GPS points of life. I mentioned a friend of mine, Brock Steele, who had sort of laid these points out for me early in my time in recovery. For me, recovery was a time when I really went deeper into my faith than I'd ever gone before. I mean, like I always say, in 1976, I asked Christ into my heart. The moment Christ moved into my heart, I moved up to my head, and I'd come down and visit him on the weekends or if I had some kind of Christian thing I had to do, but I wouldn't say that we cohabitated. In 1991, when I got into recovery, all of a sudden, after about 3 to 6 months, I realized that I've moved out of my head. I no longer live there, and I'd come in, and I was beginning to really live the way I think I was called to, in relationship fully with the living God. Now, I didn't do it all the time. I didn't do it right at all. It's not about getting it right. It's about rather living in a way where you live knowing that you can trust. I mean, all of us, I think, probably struggle with trust. You know, whether you like to admit it or not, you know, some of it you'd say, well, you know, I don't trust many people. Or it's that place where you get in where you just wonder somehow what's going to happen next. And so what happens when you don't trust? When you don't trust, the first symptom of not trusting is control. You try and control everything that's around you. You know? And it drives you crazy, doesn't it? When you start trying to control everything around you. And even when you're not controlling, there's a lot of times a lot of us say, well, I'm not a control freak. But the truth of the matter is you're controlling by not controlling. You're controlling by saying, well, it's somebody else's fault, you know? But really, it's where you have to come in and you say, no, I trust God. And so that's, I'm going to initiate moving in, but I'm going to trust in him. I'm going to align. It's sort of like instead of getting in the river of the Spirit, it's where you sort of just float along. It's where you're constantly at odds trying to get near the shore, get your feet down in the water, and somehow go at your speed rather than the speed of the river. Or you do the other thing. You get out in the middle of the river and you start swimming upstream, and you don't get anywhere with that. Tonight, the topic that I wanted to approach was humility. And I hope I can do this because I put all these parts together, and I hope that they come and they are, in a sense, in line with each other. I wanted to start with a story, and I'm going to read this story to you. A man received a promotion to the position of vice president of the company that he worked for. The promotion went to his head. And for weeks on end, he bragged to anyone and everyone that he was now the VP. His bragging came to an abrupt halt when his wife, so embarrassed by his behavior, said, "Listen, Bob, it's not that big a deal. These days, everyone's a vice president. Why, they even have a vice president of peas down at the supermarket." Somewhat deflated, Bob rang the local supermarket to find out if this was actually true. And he called the supermarket and he says, "Can I speak to the vice president of peas, please?" As he asked that, the reply came back, "Do you want fresh or frozen?" How inflated are you? How inflated are you in your own self? I mean, do you look at yourselves as a person who has attained a lot and so therefore should be respected? And how much respect do you get? I mean, how, you know, do you get respect for the things that you do or the power that you exert? You know, because you see, the thing is that so often in times our humility is not in play. And what we're called to do is to be humble. You know, believe it or not, and you've heard me say this before, I'm not exactly what you call a reader. I mean, I read short things, but I don't read usually anything that's too long. I might read a Carl Hyacinth book. You know, I love some of the, you know, or you know, Tom Dorsey, some of the local Florida writers. I mean, I love those. You know, I love Surge. But, you know, reading has never been what I'd say. I don't have a I don't have a habit of being able to sit still too long. But for Christmas, my wife gave me a book, and the book is Grant by Ron Chernow, and it's 1,000 pages long. Okay? As some of you might have read some of his stuff. He wrote Hamilton. He's written Grant. Grant is you know, it's well written. I'm so far, I'm beyond a tenth now. I'm at 15% of the book. I've read the first 150 pages, which, you want the truth, most of the time at this point, I'd quit. But it really is intriguing. The part, though, that's been intriguing me is the first part of his life, which does, look, basically from where he was born, his parents, giving his background on his brothers and himself, background on his parents, his grandparents, then him falling in love and marrying into this other family, the Dent family, and then him going off, actually, after he gets married, but his father-in-law really doesn't like him, and he's from a family. Ulysses S. Grant was from a family that, to be quite blunt, were abolitionists. They believed slavery was wrong. No, there's no leeway, nothing. Whereas he married into a family, the Dent family, that was from Missouri, who were slaveholders. And they believed, and they sided with the Confederacy. Now, one little interesting thing that I said on Sunday night that I'll repeat, Ulysses S. Grant was not born Ulysses S. Grant. Ulysses S. Grant, and when Joe did his sermon last week, I started laughing because I told him, he was born Hiram Ulysses Grant. But if you look at that name, Hiram Ulysses Grant, and you take the initials are H-U-G, hug, and he was kidded by all the children that he grew up with, and he hated that name. So what he did was he changed his name to Ulysses Hiram Grant. Now, you'd think, well, where did the S come in? Well, when he got an appointment to the military academy, West Point, the senator that appointed him got his name and his brother's name confused. His brother's name was Simpson, and he was appointed in official records as Ulysses S. Grant. Now, he thought, that's wrong. I want to be Hiram in there somewhere. Well, they couldn't change it in the Army and in the government. They couldn't change it around. But what it made it worse was he was U.S. Grant, so his name in West Point was Uncle Sam. And everybody called him that. And from that point on, he just stuck with it. But it created in him a place where, which was reflected in his upbringing, of not really knowing what his identity was. I mean, he was lost in some senses. You know, when you don't really know your name, you get lost a little bit. And the story was all about how his father was overbearing. His father-in-law was overbearing. They both wanted to tell him what to do. And, all the rumors you ever heard about Grant, about being an alcoholic and a drunk all the time, well, they're partially true. But he struggled with that constantly, intemperance. And he'd quit. Where he really got into trouble was when he was out assigned to the West, where they were up in Oregon and Northern California, especially during the gold rush, and he was out there at a fort, because his family wasn't with him and he was all by himself, he started to imbibe. And he actually left. The official records didn't say that he was knocked out because of his alcoholism, but everybody in all of the Army knew that that's the reason why he was probably knocked out. And he struggled with it right straight through the entire Civil War, through his entire life. He struggled with it. But the point I want to make is that you heard the stories, his heroism during the Mexican War. You heard about where, to be honest with you, when they were moving troops out to the West to be out at all the forts that were out there because of the gold rush, he had to lead the women and children of these families of the soldiers, he had to take them down through Nicaragua and through Panama and get them across so that they could go up in a steamship to go up. One time when he was leading them through Panama, it was cholera season. He lost over 1,000 people when he was trying to move them. Most of the children that got moved died. But when he got them to actually Panama City and he tried to set up, he actually had to set up his own hospital. And he was incredibly clever about getting it together, and they said that when he was in that hospital, he slept two hours a night for months on end, where he would actually be the nurse coming in, although he was a commanding officer. But nonetheless, at every business journey, every turn that he had, he'd fail. And he ended up getting out of the service. I mean, he ended up leaving. In 1854, he got knocked out of the military, basically. He resigned. And every business venture after that, he was lousy at. Now, the question I want to raise, because you might say, well, how does this fit with what your topic is this. Was Grant humble, or was he humbled? For some of the things that you see him do, because he never drew attention to himself, he was humble. But life also humbled him at every turn. I want you to take a moment and look at your own life. How much humility do you have, number one? Me, it's very easy to find. It's very small. But how much humility do you have? And do you have it because it just kind of naturally happened to you? Or do you have it because somewhere through your life you are humbled? Not humiliated, but humbled. Where life, being difficult as life is, even when you do things properly, somehow you knew how to meet them in a humble way, not getting frustrated, not turning back, and not weeping, not becoming a drama king or queen, not being any of those kind of things where all of a sudden you said to yourself, I'm going to take life on life's terms. You know what? Most of us talk about meeting life on life's terms. Most of us don't want to do that. I mean, that's just the reality. I mean, do you like it when you get kicked in the teeth by somebody else? It's not fair. So how are you going to respond? Are you going to respond in a way where you're arrogant and you say, it's not my fault, it's their fault? Are you going to turn around and blame everybody? You always love that definition of what do you get when you take yourself out of blame? Well, if you take yourself out of blame, blame is spelled B-L-A-M-E. So you take me out of blame, and what do you got? Blah, 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 blah. The truth of the matter is that most of us live in a world of blame. Look at the newspapers any day you want. There is always somebody blaming somebody else for things that they got into. When are we going to take responsibility? When are we going to step up? Because it's in stepping up and saying, I didn't do everything correctly. Instead of pointing the finger at somebody else, pointing these fingers at yourself and saying, wait a second, maybe this is just part of the process of me being humbled so I can truly become what I'm called to be. You know, it's interesting. Anthony Bloom, in his book, Living Prayer, says this. Basically, humility is the attitude of one who stands constantly under the judgment of God. It is the attitude of one who is like the soil. Humility comes from the Latin word humus, fertile ground. The fertile ground is there, unnoticed, taken for granted, always there to be trod upon. It is silent, inconspicuous, dark, yet is always ready to receive any seed, ready to give its substance and life. The more lowly, the more fruitful, because it becomes real fertile when it accepts all the refuse of the earth. It is so low that nothing can soil it, abase it, humiliate it. It has accepted the last place and cannot go any lower. In that position, nothing can shatter the soul's serenity, its peace, and its joy. Humility is where all of a sudden you're at peace with inside yourself. You don't have to look for somebody to rise you up. You know, most of us, we need affirmation from everybody around us. I mean, think about it. You know, we want everybody to tell us how wonderful we are. And maybe when you're growing up, you need that. But when you get to a certain age, hopefully you're humble enough to know, wait a second, the joy that I have isn't dependent upon what somebody else receives or doesn't receive. The joy that I have comes from within inside me. And that joy comes from being humble. It comes from being right in the place that you're called to be. It's where you realize that, wait a second, I don't, it's nice to get that affirmation. It's wonderful to feel that other people like me, but I don't have to strive after that. Isn't that what the Christian gospel really is about? I mean, if you really think about it, God loves you, why? For anything you did? Not a thing you did. He loves you just for who you are, unconditionally. But you know what gets in the way of you experiencing the love of God? It's when you feel this sense of pride. Well, by God, I deserve it. You know, I did this really well. You know, something just crossed my mind that I want to share with you. When I was doing ministry, but I was still drinking, especially when I was doing youth ministry, I'd never drink when I had kids around or anything like that. I wouldn't. But the worst drunks that I ever had in my life were right after I did an incredible camp with kids away. And I'd go from that weekend where all these kids, some of them came to know Jesus for the very first time, they had a great time, they were always happy, they were always excited, and I'd go back to the house that I lived in, and I'd sit down, and I'd get at least one 12-pack of beer, maybe more, and I'd sit there and say, you know, I really deserve this. I deserve this. You know, I did a really good job. God, why can't you tell me? Well, why do I need to drink to feel like I did a good job? And yet that was the disease that I had. You know what? Even without alcohol, there's times that I'm right back in that same spot where I so desire for somebody to say, oh, Jimmy, you are just wonderful today. Oh, Jimmy. And you know what? You don't always get that from your spouse. It's not that Sally doesn't love me, but, you know, we're together all the time. You know, and if she had to do that all the time, God, I'd probably be going, oh. I mean, it can't work that way. You do affirm each other, but you don't have. Somehow you have to have it come from within. And I'll be upfront with you, I'm still learning that. I'm still learning that. It's hard to learn that. That sense of joy. But it happens when you finally get the pride out of the way, that sense of, you know, I'm pretty good. And I'm cute, too. You know, and all of a sudden you go inside and you say, no, I'm just Jim. I'm just me. Life changes then. Then you can do things genuinely. You know, I'll be upfront with you. You know, I should almost sit down and think about it, because since the broken leg, a lot of things have changed. My sense of, I got to do it all. Somehow I got to show up at everything. You know, I can't do that anymore. And you can ask Katie. I mean, I've backed off on certain things. I'll show up and get my work done, but I don't have to do everything anymore. You know, I just have to be me. And as being me, I'm going to be more effective for the people that are around me than if I'm not me. And if I set aside my sense of, I did it, you know, then I can let God do it through me. And that's what it's really supposed to be, because that's only when you can really have God work through you, is when you actually have the humility to allow God to work through you. Do you have that humility? Do you work on that humility? I mean, because you got to work on it. It can't just happen. And you know how you work on it? You put other people first. And you do it not with the sense of, oh, I got to put somebody else first because that's what I'm supposed to do. But where you actually naturally kind of start doing it, it's where all of a sudden you say to yourself, well, what's going on in their life instead of talking about me? You know? I mean, how many of you have grandchildren that when they come to visit you, they immediately sit down with you and they pull out their cell phones? And they're there like this. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. Or how many of you do that to somebody else? I mean, when do you turn this thing off? You know, when do you get to the place where you say, okay, I'm not going to be daydreaming about something else when somebody's talking to me? Yeah, I had a boss that was, you know, the rector of a church that I worked for, and I'll never forget, this couple came in to me that had gone to him for marriage counseling, and they looked at me, and when they sat down with me, they said, well, I said, didn't you go to Father, you know, whoever, and already go for some counseling with him? And they said, yes, we did. And before we get started, they looked at me and said, are you going to be looking at your nails the whole time when we're talking to you? And I said, what do you mean? And it said, well, when we saw him, he was like this. And I said, huh? They said, I don't think he heard a word we said. Are you going to do that to us? I'll tell you right now, if I'd done it to somebody before, I might have. I didn't do it to that couple at all. And I was pretty aware from that point on, I'm not doing that to anybody because I don't want to get busted. But I also wanted to make sure that I was really centered for them. So when you pick up the phone and somebody's yapping on the phone for a long period of time, you know, have you ever done where they're yapping on the thing, you set the phone down, you walk away, you get yourself a drink, you come back, and they're still going? I've had that. But that's where actually what I do now is just say, listen, I understand you have something really important. Let's get together, sit down, and talk it out, because this is not going to happen on this phone the way it's going to happen. It's not going to work. So I cut it short, and I said, and then I put the onus on them. If you really want to talk about it, let's talk face to face. Because the truth of the matter is then you can read each other, and then you can really know whether you're listening and they're listening and everybody's listening. But if you try and do it on the phone, you don't get too far. And it all comes down to what? It comes down to being honest, because humility is honesty. It's really looking at yourself. It's not looking at the other person and saying, how does this reflect on me? It's just saying, no, here I am, just as I am. But it's getting your ego out of the way. Or as the scripture says in Mark chapter 8, it says this, if anyone wants to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what does it profit them to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? It's so interesting because he's not talking about life. He's saying this. If anybody wants to become my followers, let them deny themselves. Not deny their life, but deny themselves. How do you deny yourself? How do you deny yourself? Have you ever done it? Where you actually said, and I'm not talking about where, well, I gave up sugar or alcohol. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about where you set yourself aside for the other person. Where you actually were there and said, there are a lot of things on my mind right now, but they're important. They're more important than I am. They are much more important than I am. You know, I'd really much rather be doing this, but no. I really choose to do this because this is much more important. It's where you all of a sudden set yourself in there and you give up of yourself. You give over your right in a way. You know, in this community, in this country right now, nobody wants to seem to give up their rights. You know, I mean, that drives me a little crazy. I mean, if you really think about it, being in a community demands you give up your rights. At least some of them. It means you say to yourself, I want to be in a community to do that. I can't do everything that maybe I have a right to do. I mean, let's put online here. You drive out of here? Anybody get to drive 90 miles an hour down Saxon out of here? Because you gave up your right to do that by living in this community. You can drive 35, but you're not called to drive over 35. The law has set it up. Why did it set up? Because they deemed that the safest speed for all involved is 35. That's why they set it up. They said that it was. And so you gave up your right. Because truth matters, anybody here not be able to? Where's Schubert? Schubert, you got that vet. You can do 90 miles an hour in that. You know? But you say, no, even though I got a car that can easily do 90 miles an hour. You know, without blinking an eye, and hold the road and get around any animal that crosses, probably. You choose not to do it because you say to yourself, no, I choose not to do that. And in this country, at this point, that's what drives me crazy, because the truth of the matter is, you know what? We've got to give up some of our rights so that we can get along and live along and be safe for each other. The problem is, it's okay for the other guy to give up his right, but I don't want to give up my right. Well, that's where you come in and say, no, I want to deny myself. I'm going to deny myself this right that I have so that it's better for the entire community. Or I'm going to limit that right that I have. And maybe it's limit it, not even deny it. But limit that right that I have so that it's good for the whole community. That's humility. That's where things grow. Humus. It's good soil. But unless you get that humus, nothing can grow. Because to tell you the truth, if you're prideful, the soil is too hard. Nothing's going to permeate it. So the question really comes is, do you want to be a person who grows? It doesn't happen just because you were born and, oh, I was just born humble. Listen, if you have a grandchild coming or a child coming, let's take them out, let them be born in a log cabin, but then shift them out of it right afterwards. You know, they might have been born into humble surroundings, but they'll change real quick as soon as they get some money under their belt. But when you all of a sudden you acknowledge the brokenness of this world, you acknowledge the fact that success doesn't always come, you realize that failure isn't a measure of your worth, but it's a chance to start again. And you realize that God is at work within you to mold and shape you every step of the way, and that you weren't created just for yourself to have your own little world the way you want it, where everything's right there, but you were created to serve the world that's about you and the community that's about you, where you give up your life and your comfort for the people that live around you. Then humility starts. That's when all of a sudden things really become alive. And all of a sudden you realize that you begin to work in a way that's different than you've ever worked before. You don't mind listening to somebody who's your neighbor, who's quite frankly crazy. But they need to have somebody listen to. You know, the other day I walked in to get my computer at that place on Route 1. I don't even know the name of it. Dana had taken it in. I walked in and I started laughing at myself because when I walked in, the guy looks at me and goes, well, which computer is it? I said, well, it's a Mac, but I think it's Pro something or other. He goes, you don't know much about computers, do you? And I said, no. Meanwhile, I'm listening to this other sales guy who's on the phone with somebody. And I hear him say at least 5 times in a span of maybe 3 minutes, look, that's just junk mail that's coming in. They didn't get your email address. You can just delete it. Nothing's going to happen to your computer. Don't worry. A virus isn't going to come in if you delete this now. Just don't do that. And then I know that you think it's your ex-wife, but it may not be your ex-wife. And then he goes, well, no, I don't think her children might want it either. And I'm sitting listening to this guy thinking, maybe I walked into a counseling center. This isn't a computer office. The guy got off the phone. I looked and I said, you're really a nice guy. I said, thank you for doing that. He goes, and this is exactly what he said. The guy doesn't need any help from us. He just needed somebody to listen to him. That's it. Are you capable of listening to somebody? Not for your own gain? Are you capable of saying, you know what? They've got issues. They aren't mine. I'm sorry for the way they are. Let me let it go. Or do you have to be right? Are you capable of saying to yourself, you know, I'm sorry it's going this way, but I'm not going to get my pride in the way. I'm not going to get my pride in the way. I don't need to prove anything. If you're a grandparent or a parent, let me ask you a question. Your grandchildren call you on your birthday every time? Because I bet you they don't. I guarantee that all of you have had somebody who you thought, well, they should know this anniversary in my life. They should know it. And they don't recall it, or they're busy. Are you going to let your pride get in the way and say, they don't care about me, so I'm not going to care about them? I mean, the number of people that have passed through my office that have gotten mad at their grandchild who is 7 years old because they didn't recognize the grandfather who's 70 years old's birthday, and I look at them and say, what? And yet they're serious. And you know what, truth? It does hurt. But that's where they are. Do you take life on life's terms? Do you meet life where it really is? Or do you have to mold and shape it to have it become what you want it to be? Because if you have to mold and shape it to what you want to be, then you might as well go out the door right now, because this humility talk's not going to touch you. You know, I want to end with a story. It's a little bit of a long story. I'm going to read it to you. It's called I Love My Garbage Man. I've been working much too long on this job. I guess things could have been worse. I certainly wasn't doing hard labor, but going door to door asking questions as a representative of the federal government wasn't the most satisfying position either. It was August. It was hot. I had to wear a tie. Hello, my name is Bob Perks, and we are doing a survey in this neighborhood. I'm not interested. Goodbye. Slam. Block. You can't imagine how many times I've heard that. I finally caught on and began with, before you slam the door, I'm not selling anything, and I just need to ask a few questions about yourself and the community. The young woman inside the doorway paused for a moment, raised her eyebrows as she shrugged her shoulders, confused by my rude introduction. Sure, come on in. Don't mind the mess, it's tough keeping up with my kids. It was an older home in a section of the valley where people with meager income found affordable shelter. With the little they had, the home looked comfortable and welcoming. I just need to ask a few questions about yourself and family. Although this may sound personal, I won't need to use your names. This information will be used. She interrupted me. Would you like a glass of cold water? You look like you've had a rough day. Why, yes, I said eagerly. Just as she replied with the water, a man came walking in the front door. It was her husband. Joe, this man is here to do a survey. I stood and politely introduced myself. Joe was tall and lean. His face was rough and aged looking, although I figured he was in his early 20s. His hands were like leather, the kind of hands you get from working hard, not pushing pencils. She leaned towards him, kissed him gently on the cheek. As they looked at each other, you could see the love that held them together. She smiled and tilted her head, laying it on his shoulder. He touched her face with his hands and softly said, I love you. They may not have had material wealth, but these two were richer than most people I know. They had a powerful love, the kind of love that keeps your head up when things aren't looking down or are looking down. Joe works for the borough, she said. What do you do? I asked. She jumped right in, not letting him answer. Joe collects garbage. You know, I'm so proud of him. Honey, I'm sure the man doesn't want to hear about this, said Joe. No, I really do, I said. You see, Bob, Joe is the best garbage man in the borough. He can stack more garbage on the truck than anyone else. He gets so much in one truck that they don't have to make as many runs, she said with passion. In the long run, Joe continues, I save the borough money. Man hours are down and the cost per truck is less. There was silence. I didn't know what to say. I shook my head, searching for the right words. That's incredible. Most people would gripe about a job like that. It certainly is a difficult one. But your attitude about it is amazing, I said. She walked over to the shelf next to the couch. As she turned, she held in her hand a small framed paper. When we had our third child, Joe lost his job. We were unemployed for a time and then eventually welfare. He couldn't find work anywhere. Then one day he was sent on an interview here in this community. They offered him the job he now holds. He came home depressed and ashamed, telling me this was the best he could do. It actually paid less than what we had made on welfare. She paused for a moment and walked towards Joe. I have always been proud of him and always will be. You see, I don't think the job makes the man. I believe the man makes the job. We needed to live in the borough in order to work here, so we rented this home, Joe said. When we moved in, this quote was hanging on the wall just inside the front door. It has made all the difference to us. I knew that Joe was doing the right thing, she said, as she handed me the frame. It said, if a man is called to be a street sweeper, he should sweep the streets, even as Michelangelo painted or Beethoven composed music, or Shakespeare wrote poetry. He should sweep streets so well that all the host of heaven and earth will pause to say, here lived a great street sweeper who did his job well, Martin Luther King. I love him for who he is, but what he does the best. I love my garbage man. You know, I end with that story because to me, that's where it is. You know, life is hard. Life's not fair. What are you doing with it, though? Because if you're humble, you'll do a lot with it. You'll take all that life has dealt you, good and bad, and you'll put it in the soil, and somehow you'll grow out of it. But if you simply say, I don't deserve this, I resent this, I blame those other people for it, then you know what? Nothing much is going to grow. And what's really not going to grow is your relationship with the living God. Because he needs humble men and women. He needs people who will say, I just want to follow you. He needs people to say, I'm going to deny myself, I'm going to take up my cross, and I'm going to follow you. I want to thank you for this evening, and I want to thank you for being here. And I pray that somehow in the midst of tonight and tomorrow and the day after that, somehow you look deep into your heart and you look at some of the things that have gone on in your life that didn't seem fair, didn't seem right, and you say to yourself, okay, God, how do you want me to use them now? How do you want me to become what I'm called to be? And somehow bring that into you so that fertile ground that can make anything grow takes place within you. You have the capacity to do that. It's in the name of Jesus that we pray. Amen. Thank you.